really being out of sorts, having been away from their homes for so long.
Dana Hedgepeth, we only have about a minute left. How has the impact of these schools closed at the beginning of the 70s impacted, what, half a century later?
Wow, that's a good question and a big one. The impact of these schools is still being felt in many ways. As I mentioned, there are several hundred survivors from these schools. They're dealing with the traumas of having gone through these schools, of having been taken away from their tribe, their communities, their families. That has a generational impact on how they raised their children, or how they did not know how to raise their children, of grappling with what it means to be away from your home, away from your community, away from your traditions, away from your language. That's left a huge knowledge gap, as we Native Americans call it, in language and in culture. There is a rebuilding of those languages and of those culture traditions, but still it is very, very hard to deal with that trauma. Many Native American survivors are only now beginning to talk about these traumas from decades ago.
We want to thank you for being with us. And unfortunately, we've run out of time, but your work is incredible. And we're going to link to your articles. Dana Hedgepeth, Native American journalist with the Washington Post, member of the Haliwasaponi tribe of North Carolina, 25 years at the Washington Post. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM.
We know a KBOO membership is at the top of everyone's wish list this season. Give the gift of supporting grassroots community media by making a donation during KBOO's Catalog of Connections year-end campaign. And your donation will be matched dollar for dollar up to $20,000. Your contribution will go towards your favorite music, news, and public affairs programming all year long. Just go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to the number 44321.
KBOO.
You are listening to KBOO Community Radio, and this is KBOO News Year in Review. Between now and the new year, we'll be looking back at some of our favorite and most important stories from 2024. I'm Althea Billings, the news director. In this episode, we'll be looking back at our special election series, Running on Air. For 2.5 months, we put out a second daily show with a handful of candidates at a roundtable each time from the different districts. It was an enormous amount of effort, but it paid off. We got to have a unique look into the personalities and the policies that are going to lead Portland into its next chapter. Today, we're going back to the episodes that featured the winners from District 4, which represents the west side of the city, and Sellwood. The winners from that district were Mitch Green, Eric Zimmerman, and Olivia Clark. We'll be hearing from all of them from across the different episodes that they were a part of. Before we get into the meat of today's episode, we want to thank everyone who has helped to contribute to our end of year membership drive so far. Our goal is to raise $75,000 before January 1st, and we can't do it without your support. The theme of this drive is Catalog of Connections, which is something that KBOO brings to you every single weekday. Do you want to be connected to your community and the issues that matter to you the most? That's what you tune into KBOO for. We can't do it without you, so if KBOO has meant something to you this year, consider supporting us with a donation. You can go online to kboo.fm/give to donate, or you can text KBOO to 44321. We also accept checks. That address is 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, 97214. Thank you so much for being a part of our community. Now, on to the show.
We're talking today with candidates running to represent District 4, which covers all of Portland's West Side and Sellwood. We'll be hearing from Olivia Clark.
Hi, Barbara.
So, I want to start by talking about this new form of government. In what ways has the change of government inspired you to run for city council? Okay, Olivia?
To your question, Barbara, and thanks for having us here today. I'm really excited about the fact that we're going to have a city manager form of government, that we're going to have professional management, that we're not going to have politicians running the bureau. I think that's one of the most exciting things about this, in addition to what Tony said about constituent relations. But we're going to have professional management finally. And we've been an outlier for years. So this is bringing us into the 21st century in terms of city management. So I'm excited about that. And the more I campaign, the more I learn about really the silver linings to this change in government. I think it's very positive, although it's going to be a rough start, I think, with, you know, 12 people who have to figure out how to work together to really fulfill the promises that the city has made to all the electorate, all the people that live in Portland. We have a difficult time executing on the promises in Portland, so I think that this new form of government is going to help with that. So that's exciting to me.
It seemed like everybody in the city agreed we needed to get rid of the commission form of government and we needed to have a city administrator. However, there was a lot of contention about the rest of the charter change. Things that were of concern were having 12 city council members, having more than one representative per district, and the ways that the ranked choice voting was going to work for the council candidates. Well, first of all, did you vote for the charter change? And secondly, what were your concerns about it?
I didn't vote for the charter change. I thought it was too much at one time. I knew we needed to change the form of government. I wasn't sure about ranked choice voting or three people elected from each district. I mean, we're going to have to make this up as we go along after the election. The three people who are elected from each district are going to have to figure out how to divide up the issues, how to respond to constituents, if they're going to have district offices. There's a lot to be decided, that to be made up, really, as we go along. So that really concerned me. But here we are. We have it. We're going to make it work. And I'm pretty optimistic about it now, Barbara.
Oh, good. Traditionally, the city council represents the West Side. So I wanted to talk about the powers that used to be and how that might be challenged with this kind of election. The Portland Business Alliance and its allied business interests, like the Working Waterfront, have had a great deal of control over what happened in Portland up until about 20 years ago. And then somehow these other candidates got elected, and the city really started to shift and started to do things that a lot of us thought were really in the right direction and very progressive, particularly around environmental issues. And the Portland Business Alliance and a bunch of other business interests cramped down, and lots of money flooded the elections in 2018 and 2020 and 2022, and our city council really shifted very drastically. I think for some people, this election is a test of how do we have the people actually be represented in government, and how do we pull away from the kind of uneven dominance that the business community and the downtown business in particular has. So, Olivia, you're up next.
Sure. Tony and I are both what's considered crossover candidates because we do have labor and business support. I have a tremendous amount of labor support and the business community. And I think that 75% crossover, I think that both sides, if you want to call it that, are looking for people who can work together, people who can work across the aisle, people who can form a coalition, people who are collaborative, that can actually get something done. So, and I think that's part of why certain people were selected for those crossover endorsements. I want to add on that District 1 and District 4 actually have a lot more in common than you might think. And if you listen to some of the candidates talk about their priorities, they're the same priorities that we have in District 4. Both Tony and I were endorsed by the police and the firefighters, and that's a big issue in District 1 as well. Some of the lead candidates over there are supportive of that as well. So that's going to be exciting to see how the people in all four districts can work across the aisle, can work together. Hopefully we're going to have more consensus, that we don't have to rely on, you know, seven votes to get something done. Hopefully we'll have more agreement than that, but there's going to be a natural tension. I just want to point out, though, that we have more in common with District 1 than you might think, and if you listen to some of those candidates.
Well, I wanted to continue a little bit with the domination that the business communities had on Portland politics. And so I wonder how you see, even though you're talking about this coalition of business and union leaders, let's add the environmental community to that. Let's add the neighborhood associations to that. And how do they actually penetrate the hegemony, which to me seems that the business community feels entitled to, and this is like 150 years of entitlement.
Yeah, I would just say that I come from a neighborhood association background, both in Eugene, Salem, and in Portland. I'm active in my neighborhood association. And I don't think you can discount them, as well as the people who have organized up in North Portland in Linton, the Tank the Tanks group. They have done an amazing job, a grassroots effort to build a broad-based coalition. They're informing the public. They have a tremendous amount of community engagement. And I think that's a model. I think that's what's coming. They have, in their 12-point their plan, they're actually activating that, and that's exciting. And I don't think we can discount that environment, that piece of the environmental movement, or the neighborhood associations. And I think it's incumbent on the new city council also to provide more support to community organizations that you're talking about, Barbara, as well as the neighborhood associations. They're critical to the operation of our city. And I think we're in a time, as Chris said, you know, with active union activation, there's going to be a lot more grassroots activity, a lot more pressure from the environmental community, community-based organizations. I'm very optimistic about that. I'm somebody who organized a union as well in Eugene at the University of Oregon, the teaching fellow. So, and I was a delegate to the Lane County Labor Council. I have that kind of experience with the labor community and the power of neighborhood associations. We organized Voters for Livable Neighborhoods in Eugene, which was all the low-income neighborhoods. So I'm very optimistic about the balance of things.
One of the most contentious issues, it appears to me, in Portland right now has to do with the critical energy infrastructure hub. We did a survey of cable listeners, and the biggest concern is the Zenith Energy and Tank the Tanks. And just as an aside, I found out yesterday that the Naked Bike Ride, which is going to be happening this weekend, their theme is Stop Zenith. So I think that the Stop Zenith movement has really mainstreamed, wow. As far as I can see. But I wanted to get your sense about how would you stop Zenith? And maybe we should have a little bit of background. People listeners don't know it. Zenith Energy, which moved to Portland a year after Portland declared that no more fossil fuel infrastructure could be built or expanded. That was in 2016. Zenith moved to town in 2017, snuck in, got bought out ARC Logistics, which had this property and a bunch of tanks in the critical energy infrastructure hub. And since then, they've been moving oil trains for the last 7 years. They started out with their tar sands. Now it's only Bakken oil. And there was a big debate about they needed a clean air permit from DEQ, which they were working under one that was expired for 10 years. And the city needed to give them a land use compatibility statement, approve that before they can get the permit from DEQ. The city, after a lot of pressure, denied the land use compatibility statement, and then a year later gave it to them, and it turns out there was a backroom deal. So a lot of people are saying that the city should rescind the looks. They have the ability to do it. So I wanted to know, first of all, what your thoughts are about the need to shut down Zenith, get them out of town, and whether you would work towards getting this Lux, the land use compatibility statement, rescinded.
So I really appreciate you bringing this up. I have to admit that I wish I had been a fly on the wall in the secret negotiations, because I have no idea what the city got out of this agreement behind closed doors. Do you know, Barbara? A black eye. Well, I always reserve the right to be smarter tomorrow. I need to learn more about this issue, and I would be listening to all the stakeholders. I don't know that Zenith in particular is the problem. It's what they're shipping is the problem.
Well, I think that actually they're the problem, too, if you know more about the company. Okay. Nationwide. It's a Houston-based company, and they have gone around the country buying out properties like ARC Logistics and expanding in places where otherwise they wouldn't be able to expand. And if we are serious about having a fossil fuel free future, mm-hmm. and decarbonizing, Zenith is not your friend.
Well, I would say that it may be something even bigger than the city of Portland. We need to bring in the state and the federal regulators to look at the safety regulations and the environmental regulations and actually enforce them. I mean, you mentioned DEQ kind of turning a blind eye for 10 years to their air quality permit. That's not tenable. I mean, I think we need a partnership between the state and the federal government to really zero in on this. and to do safety audits or to do environmental audits, to actually zero in on those permits. Our regulators are not regulating. But I think that the city of Portland can't do it all by themselves. I think they need a partnership with the state and federal government on these issues.
I think people who've been organizing against Zenith and what's going on in the CEI have, and the fears about earthquake, I think they would totally agree with you that it's a city, state, and federal. I mean, the county's mm-hmm. been actually more proactive than the city.
Yes, yes.
But the county doesn't have any purview over
it. No, but right now the county is looking at the bond measure to hold the responsible parties who put the community at risk.
Yeah,
to
the respond, yeah.
Yeah, the respond. They're looking at that. I'm hoping that they're going to pass that. I mean, that's a huge step forward, and that's part of the whole Tank the Tank CEI Hub plan. That's one of the steps forward.
Well, we've got a caller question, and that is, please give us your thoughts on our housing crisis and our citywide homelessness issue.
Yeah, thanks, Barbara. The new city council has to use every lever that it has at their disposal to make it easier to develop affordable housing. I began my career as an affordable housing advocate and organized a statewide coalition to get the state more involved in affordable housing. And I know what those levers are. It's the permitting system. In fact, I met with Dr. Andy Mendenhall at Central City Concern, and I asked him, what's the first thing that you would want the city council to do around affordable housing? You know what he said? Permitting. We need to streamline the permitting process. That was amazing.
So what does that mean? Because it's also sometimes interpreted as you get rid of environmental regulations.
You're not going to get rid of environmental regulations. We have a 120-day threshold for development right now. We completely ignore that. We need to speed that up. And some people have recommended a 90-day turnaround on permitting. But we may have some regulations that don't make sense when it comes to affordable housing because we have a crisis. We're not acting like it's a crisis.
So what would be the regulations that don't make sense?
I'm going to admit that I don't know what all of them are. I mean, it could be a third-level design review, for example, and there are others. There's two other things I want to mention is that we need to align the city, the county, and the state to all be pulling in the same direction, and we're not. You know, we've been coming out of an era of fighting with each other. We also need all the nonprofits that are working on affordable housing to be more coordinated and aligned. And lastly, I would say we need to put pressure on the federal government to get back into the housing business. You know, the Reagan administration cut all of our public housing programs, and as well as many other social service programs. We need to go back to those days where the federal government directly invests in affordable housing so that we have housing. In Europe, it's called social housing. Here, it was called public housing. And that housing gets built and stays out of the private market so that it's affordable over time. We have to go back to that kind of a system. But that would mean that we all have to pull in the same direction and lobby the federal government to get back in the housing business, because housing is also healthcare. But those three things have to happen.
I want to move on because we're really running out of time, and there's two big things I want to talk about. This came up in the last forum we did last week, is two programs that have been somewhat controversial with certain people on the city council that remain nameless. But one is the Portland Street Response, and the other one is the Portland Clean Energy Fund. So I wanted to get a sense from each of you, if you support these programs, and what would you do to enhance them?
Mm-hmm. Great. Back to the public safety issue. The Portland Street Response is a vital member of the entire public safety ecosystem that we have. I've stated publicly that we need to expand their authorities. They need to be able to transport. They also need better oversight.
I say also they need to have solid funding, because that was one of the challenges that Rene Gonzalez tried to take away their funding.
Exactly. And that's a question really for our whole public safety ecosystem. I would like to see the local public safety coordinating council, which is a body that was established back during Kitzhaber's administration when I was there, actually function and have street response at the table and have everybody, again, this is my theme, is have everybody pulling in the same direction when it comes to public safety. That ecosystem is not as coordinated as it could be, and it should be at the LPSC, the local public safety coordinating council. So I think expanding their authorities, having more oversight, having more money, all of that is good and needed. As far as PSEF goes, there's more revenue. I would like us to go back to the city's climate emergency plan and see what are the other elements in that plan that we could fund. You know, whether it's more street trees or expanding it to some other area that's highlighted in that plan. We need to go back and review that. I think it's a little elastic, and I think you need to go back, as I said, to the city's climate emergency plan and see what we're not funding, see what we can fund. But I'm not opposed to filling a budget hole if we can stretch it to actually meet the requirements of PISA.
So how would you do that?
Well, it depends on the definition of what we're trying to do. I mean, I could argue both sides of the pothole issue, because as a cyclist and a pedestrian, they're dangerous. And on the car side, if you want cars, I mean, we still have everybody's driving, falling into potholes all over and slowing things down. That's an environmental issue as well. So, I mean, I think you have to look at the definition and see how you can mold it and expand it to meet some of these needs. But I'm potholes are a problem citywide. I hear about it all the time on the doorstep. And, you know, if we don't address potholes, this was not your question, but if we don't address potholes, having worked in transportation, I know that at some point the street is so degraded that it becomes very expensive to repair as opposed to just filling the potholes right now. But we're at a deficit here.
You are listening to KBOO Community Radio. I'm Althea Billings, the news director. In this episode of KBOO News Year in Review, we're revisiting Running on Air, our Portland candidate roundtable series. We're hearing from the winners of District 4. That's Olivia Clark, Eric Zimmerman, and Mitch Green. Consider supporting the important work we do here at KBOO with a donation during our Catalog of Connections drive. We're aiming to raise $75,000 by the end of the year. Can you help us out? Donate online at kboo.fm/give or text the word KBOO to 44321 to show your support for grassroots community radio. That's what we do it all for. Let's get back to the show.
We are together with candidate Mitch Green running for Portland City Council District 4. I wanted to start with a lightning round and followed by a deep dive on the issues that we name in the lightning round. I have my little egg timer, my 2-minute hourglass, and introduce yourself, but let us know what is the single most important issue that you think District 4 is facing.
Yeah, I'm Mitch Green. I'm running for Portland City Council in District 4. I have a PhD in economics. I'm an Army veteran. And I grew up in Portland, and I think for the folks who live in District 4, the most salient issue is visible poverty and homelessness. And that's the kind of thing that folks think about when they think about downtown, and frankly in many neighborhoods in District 4. And so I think it is pretty crucial that we act quickly to deal with the situation where folks don't have a place to sleep at night. Now, my view on that, though, is the most important issues depend upon which neighborhood that you're talking about in District 4. Like, for instance, if you live in Linton, the most important issue is the critical energy infrastructure hub and the fact that if there's an earthquake, you know, there's going to be a major ecological catastrophe there. If you live in Forest Park, the most important issue is perhaps the risk of wildfire. And if you live in Southwest Portland, you might be worried about your kids getting hit by a car. I think it really does depend upon perspective, but they're all interconnected, and I think it's about addressing things at their root cause.
Mitch, what's your take on that, these new districts and how, I mean, District 4 stands out, I think it does, as being East Side and West Side, which is, it's mixing our metaphors for people who live here. What's your take on it?
Yeah, I really like the geography of District 4. It's a large district. But it also encapsulates many different aspects of the city. So you've got our urban forests in District 4. You've got...
It's wild, really.
Yeah, and you've got the sort of... Linton is kind of a... I keep going to Linton because it's such a magical little place and has so much opportunity there. But then you've also got, Selwood and Moreland and Reed, and those are... You know, those are historically pretty progressive parts of Portland. And so there's this idea that the West Side is just where all the rich people live, which is probably true. But it's also home. District 4 is home to some of the poorest people in our city. And so there's really a mix of perspectives and experiences for those people who live in District 4. I think that's pretty exciting.
You had talked about the visible poverty and the homelessness in downtown that most affects you. What kind of this is a hot button issue. What would you do? What policies would you support in addressing that? And be careful, this is a hard one.
It is, but I came here for the hard questions. I am firmly in the camp of the housing first approach to dealing with homelessness, addiction, mental health crisis. And I don't think there's any shortcuts to that. It's really expensive to deal with houselessness after it's happened. And so I strongly favor, putting in place policies that keep people from being homeless in the first place, right? Eviction and rental protections and stabilization measures. I also think that we can be really bold in the way that we address the use of the public purse and the scope of what the public sector does. And so if we want to house people, we should move quickly and take acquisitions from the standpoint of the city and say, we're going to build or acquire buildings that are vacant that can be used for housing first solutions. I don't think there's any way around it. And then longer term, I favor this idea called social housing, which is this idea that the public sector can and should develop its own portfolio of affordable housing that's truly affordable at all income levels. And so if you make $100,000 a year or you make $20,000 a year, you're still going to make 30% of your income. We already spent a lot on this stuff, so I think we should be more direct.
Althea Billings, the KBOO News director, did a major survey of KBOO listeners about what were the most important issues facing the city council, and climate change was the number one issue. What policies are you going to support against that?
So I mentioned at the beginning that I do have a PhD in economics, and my specialty is in energy economics. For the last decade, I've worked for the Bonneville Power Administration, and so I know a lot about what it takes to have a resilient energy system. And part of that experience is knowing that what's normal and what's not normal when it comes to extreme weather events. What we've been experiencing in Portland over the last few years is not normal. We're not supposed to have the deep cold freezes and the heat domes that we have had over the last few years, except for once in like maybe 100 years, but we're having those almost every year. So that tells me that we've got to make infrastructure investments to make our city more resilient. I got into the race because my neighbors lost power for a week, sometimes 2 weeks. And so I think that we can, use the Portland Clean Energy Fund, pair that with the Inflation Reduction Act credits that are on the table right now to make some resiliency investments in some of our communities so that way our most vulnerable aren't exposed, literally left out in the cold.
The critical energy infrastructure hub, you're talking about the 6 mile area in Northwest Portland along the Willamette River that has all those fuel tanks. Mm-hmm. When I first moved to Portland in 1987, I was hired by Ozperg to be the state publications director, and that is what we were talking about. So much of the stuff that happens in Oregon actually happens at the state level with lobbyists, and then it gets handed down to the city. And I think that the energy policies are one of those things. Corporate lobbying hits the city of Portland like a sledgehammer, and the same thing happened with the Zenith Terminal, where the Zenith, the city of Portland, the city council created this policy that they were going to not have any further fossil fuel infrastructure. That was the phrase. And then two members of the city council met behind closed doors with Zenith and basically signed an agreement, which still shocks me. And I gather that the excuse for that is, well, Zenith said they're going to do renewables now. What will you do in the face of this disproportional and really heavy corporate lobbying? Mitch, what do you think?
Yeah, I think that lobbying is endemic to Portland. It's actually woven into the history of our city, and it's part of the reason why, I would say it's the reason why we lack the resiliency and the resources to make everyone whole and everyone safe and housed. So I'll tell you a little bit about my approach to politics. I did not pursue and I ignored invitations to participate in the United for Portland endorsement process, which is the business lobby. It's the big one. And the reason why I did it is because that's not who I aim to represent. The people that have endorsed me and the people who are supporting my campaign are students, climate leaders, socialists out knocking doors at the DSA, and labor unions. And so, if I get elected, I know which way my bread is buttered. I've chosen a side here. And I think it's very difficult to hold the line for the public if you get brought into behind closed doors even before you're elected. I think the Zenith example is really instructive, where folks feel betrayed, particularly in the climate movement. And so my promise, I guess, is to say that, I won't do that. And I think that the folks who got me elected will know how to call me in and hold me to account.
I read too many newspapers, and I think about the wildfires in Southern California. Mitch, what's your take? What if Forest Park catches on fire?
I think we do need to beef up our emergency management and response capability. But my take as an economist is to say I'd much rather prevent it. And I think that there are things that we can do to make the risk of a fire in Forest Park really minimal. For instance, I think the greatest source of risk is unsanctioned camping and people creating fires for heat and that sort of thing. And I think the way that you deal with that is you provide adequate housing for everyone so they don't have to live in a park. The next thing you can do is one thing that I would like to champion. This is probably not an immediate thing, but a kind of a longer haul thing is to say, why don't we have a green climate corps, job corps in Portland? And so you can go out and do proactive ladder fuel. That's that, you know, ivy that grows up trees and, you know, kind of quick burning stuff. Like let's trim that out. Let's do some proactive forest health maintenance in that area, that precious area of our city, so that way we can keep the risk low. Those are things that I care about. And, you know, frankly, instead of joining the Army, I would have preferred to join something like a Green Climate Corps if that existed. To pay for college. So I think that there are things that we can do. We don't have to sort of accept this world in which we're going to have to react to disasters.
What are you learning in this process about the office you want to hold that you didn't know before you started running? What do we who are voters don't even know about this town that you've been learning because you've been walking through this pathway?
I mean, that's a really interesting question. For me, what I have learned is just how deeply embedded our past decisions at the budget level, at the programmatic level, are in terms of creating the kind of like boundaries today. And so, you know, when we think about all the policies we want to pass and how to pay for it and what are the trade-offs, you really get a close-up look to the consequences of a previous generation.